You're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag SDRask podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and I'm here with Greg Kokel. Hi, Greg.
The president and founder of Stand to Reason. I never get a title here. Who is that guy anyway? All right.
So today we're going to start a little differently. A couple episodes ago, there was a question from Doug about whether or not biblically step-siblings can marry. And after we talked about it, I said at the end, well, maybe there's a law that in the Old Testament that would shed some light on the morality of this. And then wouldn't you know it, the very next day after we recorded that, I was reading in Leviticus and I came across something that I actually think is relevant to this.
Oh, man, what a coincidence.
So I thought we'd go back to that. But Greg, did you want to sum up kind of what we said about that or what you said?
Quickly, first, there's a distinction between a step-sibling and a half-sibling. In a step-sibling, there's no genetic connection. But even if it's a half-sibling, the concern nowadays is genetic connection and kind of filtering into a gene line. We have a lot of intermarriages like some of the monarchies did in Europe. Problematic aspects that then show up, I don't think that's what God had in mind here. And I got this idea from Dennis Prager. It seemed to make so much more sense that when God makes restrictions between marriage of brothers and sisters, etc., and close family members like that, and this would include now even steps when you consider the rationale, it's so that the family unit doesn't get sexualized. So if it's completely illegal and unthinkable for brothers and sisters to marry each other or parents to be involved sexually with children, then it's a protective environment for the family. And contrast it nowadays where you have children sexualized at a very, very young age, and it's just not healthy for them. And it seems to me that's what God had in mind. That was speculative, though, on Dennis's part, as far as I know, but I thought it made a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. So we had said for sure if there's some sort of a family where the step siblings grow up together, for sure that would be out. And then we weren't sure about maybe older ones, where the parents get married and maybe the older ones, that's a different story.
Mixed family type situation of adolescents and adults.
Right. Yeah. So I did find something that I think will shed some light on this, and it was Leviticus 20:12. And here's what it says. If there is a man who lies with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall surely be put to death. They have committed incest. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. So the interesting thing about this is that we're talking about sex between two people who are not blood related. So this is a man and his son's wife. So there's no blood relation whatsoever. But they're not calling that adultery. They're calling that incest.
Right.
In other words, the marriage relationship made her his daughter,
right?
Even though she's not a daughter by blood. And so because of that, I think the same would apply to step-siblings. When the parents marry, that makes their children your sibling.
Right.
And the same would be true. If two people get married and then their parents marry, that means now, what would that, be okay? I guess that wouldn't be okay. I don't know. In other words, that the marriage relationship does make a real relationship between the other people related to them that is relevant to this.
Yeah.
And in fact, this could be the same principle that we see. There's a law against marrying a woman and her daughter. And there's a law against marrying a woman and her sister. And it's possible this is the same principle that's applying there. Once you marry one, that makes the other one a close relative.
Right.
And then it becomes incest.
Right. Now, it doesn't address the rationale, but it's entirely consistent with what we were talking about. And in fact, there's no genetic connection at all. So the problem of passing on hemophiliac genes, for example, to multiple generations and then concentrating that genetic problem in subsequent generations can't be an issue here. This is about protecting the broader family from being sexualized in some way by others. And by the way, a lot of times in the Old Testament, when a marriage happens because of a close connection with a man and a woman, and the man is sexually drawn to her, and so he wants the father to, or the mother to go get that woman so he can marry her, okay? So people are gathered. Those relationships are sometimes developed, not in the Western notion of love, but there's a sexual attraction and a desire, and so the marriage is arranged. And so if all of that is completely off the table, then it discourages people from having those kinds of desires, interests, and making those kinds of requests of those people who are now by God considered as a member of the family. Again, apart from the husband and wife, keeping sex out of the dynamic of the nuclear family.
And one thing I said also at the end of that episode is that sometimes our conscience, like, we'll have a sense that something is wrong without exactly being able to point to something that says it's wrong in mm-hmm. the Bible. And this comes as we develop our consciences and as we develop our understanding of morality. And we do that, we shape those things by reading the Bible.
Right.
And so this is part of the reason why Paul says we should not go against our conscience. So if you feel that something is wrong, even if you haven't understood the reasoning behind that, we're not supposed to go against that because we're not supposed to train ourselves to go against our conscience.
Right.
Even if it's not quite perfectly formed and informed. So I guess my point is just this is part of the reason why we need to be reading through the whole Bible, because these things, they go into us, they shape our worldview, they shape our understanding of morality, and they help us to answer questions sometimes we don't even know exactly why, but our whole worldview has been shaped by so many things in the Bible that it makes us better able to know what the will of God is in terms of morality
right.
as we're making decisions in the world.
Yeah, this is such a great point. Another observation here, though, is for me is that we always talk about moral intuitions and conscience like something built in, but now we're talking about training at the same time, and the two are not opposed to each other. When we have an ability to understand basic mathematical concepts, all right, that 2 + 2 = 4, you know, and 2 is the square root of 4, and that once we begin to understand what these terms mean, then the truthfulness of them is commended by our, shall we say, mathematical intuitions. We have these capabilities inside to understand these concepts, even though there's a process of learning that's associated with it. So we learn our multiplication tables by rote, and then later we come to understand how they work. And in the understanding, it comports or fits with our moral intuition. I'm sorry, our rational intuitions about those things. So there's no inconsistency with the idea of saying that we have built-in moral notions, and those need to be trained and informed. And sometimes, as you mentioned, that our moral notions are improperly informed because of, you know, strange behaviors or things in a culture, whatever. We have emphases, socialization, things that misdirect our conscience. And this is why it's good to have a like the scripture as a compass, a moral compass to guide that. So the two are not inconsistent with each other.
I can remember a point many years ago when I made a conscious decision, you know, I'm going to trust that the Bible is God's wisdom, even when it feels like you said, when our conscience is informed against that by the culture wrongly, sometimes we need to be corrected by the Bible.
Right.
And so if you are willing to place yourself under the authority of God and His Word, you will be in the best position to have your conscience shaped correctly. And so read through Proverbs, read through the wisdom literature, but also read through the entire thing, because there are things you learn about God and who He is and what He wants for us by reading through the entire story, not just the laws or the Proverbs.
It's interesting. I started Leviticus yesterday, just in my own pattern of reading, and I'm curious how you just happened to run across those passages. You were just reflecting and meditating and on the Mosaic Law, or was it part of your progressive reading, or how did that work?
It was part of my reading through the Old Testament, so that's where I happened to be.
Are you using the discipleship thing that I use? What is it called? The book at a time Bible reading plan?
No. Oh. I have an app. It's called Bible Box, and you check off what you've read. So I go straight through the Old Testament, and then I read through the New Testament more than once during the year. But at the beginning of the year, I'm usually...
Oh, you do it all in a year then? Oh,
yeah.
You really? Okay. Because
yeah.
I've kind of recommended against that, unless people are like Amy, you know, like super spiritual. But I don't go that fast, partly because, you know, generally those book at a Bible in a year reading plans require a lot of reading every day. And I think, and I know what happened with me when I tried to do that, I just would speed read to get the check in the box. And so I'm missing a lot of stuff, you know. So I started July 18th, 2020. And just through, I'm not even through the first page, I'm not even 10% of the Bible, but that's okay. When I'm done in 3 years, I'll just start over again. And that's kind of my point there.
Well, we mentioned this a couple episodes ago also, the idea that when you're reading at a more normal pace, like you would a normal book, you see it in a different way, you get different things out of it. So my recommendation is, especially if you are a new reader to the Bible and you have no idea what the story is, or you're not that familiar with it, sometimes reading it like a normal book at a normal speed, chapters at a time, will help you get the bigger picture.
Yeah, that's good. Don't slow down for the things you don't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, that's good advice. And I had mentioned too at the time that there are times when I'm looking for something in the book of Acts, some pattern. And so I start in Acts 1:1 and go right to the end. And I'm kind of speed reading of a sort, skim reading. But it's amazing what you get out of it. You get this big picture feel. So both have their advantages.
And also just the whole idea of kind of saturating yourself with the whole worldview. I think that it makes a big difference. And you can always take time to focus on a few things, especially. And the way I do that is I do some memorization, and then I'm focusing way more closely on a smaller passage.
When you memorize, not verses, but you memorize whole passages like chapters, right?
Yes.
As I recall, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe one time we can talk about that if people want tips for that. I think I did a podcast on that for a regular podcast years ago with tips for memorization, if anyone wants to look that up on our website at str.org.
Yeah, next time you fill in for me on the show, like this summer when I have some time off.
Maybe I could do that again.
Yeah, do that as a commentary. That'd be great.
So let's go on to the next question. This one comes from Joseph Arnold. Would applying our culture's standards of gender to race be a good way of using the taking the roof off tactic? For example, we can be any race we want or think we are.
Well, yeah, I think that's actually been tried. There's a fellow associated with Dennis Prager who goes around campus and he interviews students and asks them these questions. And so first question had to do with gender. And of course, they were all completely politically correct. If he believed he was a woman, then that's true for him. And then he started using other examples. What if I thought I was black? Or what if I thought I was a 6'7" Asian woman? He's a short little guy, you know, a Caucasian guy. And this is when they began to balk. So that's an example in that video. It's famous. It's made the rounds. You might know the name of the guy if people wanted to look it up. But it's an example of taking the roof off. That's right. And, I part of my sense regarding this whole gender issue is people, I'm not sure that it depends how deeply socialized they are about this issue. But a lot of people, I think, who are willing to go along with this and play along and affirm gender is whatever you think in your mind is not because they are deeply committed to that notion, but because they're trying to be nice. They want to be nice. We don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, so we just want to be nice. Now, of course, the problem with that is sometimes when you're nice, it has other consequences. People who have gender genuine gender dysphoria have a real significant psychological problem. I know it's very politically incorrect to say that, but it's obvious. If you have a male body and you think you're a woman, this is – here, let me give an alternative. If you have a human body and you thought you're a rabbit, how would you think about that? Now, I'm not trying to make fun at all. I'm just giving another example. Well, people would – even if a person, like in the questioning, thought was asked, well, if I was – thought I was a 7-foot-tall Chinese woman, they balked at that, okay? So, I mean, this is not healthy. And evidence of it is these folk have a very, very high suicide rate. I mean, it's exorbitantly high. I think 25 times the national average. And this is not – there's no reason to believe this is because Christians don't believe what they believe about. Everybody is encouraging them. How are Christians making them kill themselves? There's something inside that is wrong. In fact, that's an acknowledgement. When a person says, I'm a woman in a man's body, they're acknowledging there's a mismatch. And they've got to change something, and that's why they have operations, so that they can try to get their body to match their mind and have unity. So all of that is evidence that something's amiss here, and it's not good to encourage the circumstance of that. Unfortunately, it's more and more the case where the law doesn't even allow you to help a person in that situation, certainly a minor in many states, including California. So this is where political correctness and well-meaning people, and I think they are well-meaning in most cases, are doing terrible damage to other human beings.
Mm-hmm. This actually has happened where just a few years ago, there was a woman who claimed to be Black and she was heading up some organization.
Right.
And then they discovered that she wasn't really. And there was a big scandal.
Right.
And at the time, people were saying, but
yeah,
but why isn't she if she thinks she is? Because they were trying to make that point. And they didn't make much headway. I think it's a perfectly valid way of taking the roof off of this entire situation.
Right.
Unfortunately, people don't see it that way. And I think it's because they have rejected the idea that there is any physical basis to gender whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they still believe there's a physical basis to race. And so when you compare the two, they won't even understand what you're saying because they're rejecting the very thing that makes it the analogy work, which is that sex is based on biology.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on a physical characteristic. And so they reject that, so they can't even see how this matches. And I mean, that could be one reason why I think it failed. But another reason could be that, like you said, Greg, I don't think this is based on principle. I think it's based on what's acceptable in the culture right now mm-hmm. to say.
Right.
And so people don't seem to care all that much about being consistent and reasoning mm-hmm. according to principles. They care a lot more about saying what's acceptable and what's right.
But what's acceptable is also, I mean, let's be honest, is what's safe in the culture. Because if you don't march to the beat of their drummer, you're going to get hurt one way or another. I mean, they may just make you feel bad and call you names and isolate you socially, or they may fire you, you know, and that happens too. You may lose your standing in really important ways. They may be a lawsuit against you. So there are all ways of making people walk in lockstep here. And now there was something else in my mind that was important. I'm trying to remember what it was. Just for people who aren't familiar with the terminology here, taking the roof off is in the tactics book. And the idea there is you take another person's point of view and you take it seriously and then you start applying it consistently across the board. You give it a test drive and see where it leads. And if it leads to lunacy, which some views do, then there's something wrong with where you started with this view. You know, if you're driving off a cliff, for goodness sake, you know, maybe we ought to reconsider this. But I know what it was that I was going to say. The irony, though, when they still accept race but not gender, is race is much less stable as a biological fact. In fact, for many years, people have denied that race has any biological significance at all, because it's it's hard to pin down, and you have all these mixtures. But you still have human beings that are binary sexually. And that's how they reproduce, with very, very rare exceptions, where something is clearly gone wrong and there's ambiguity there from birth. It just shows how goofy people are when they think about this.
Right. When you're talking about race, it's a physical characteristic in terms of the color of a person's skin, but there's certainly no important biological difference between people that puts them in specific categories,
right?
Like there is with sex. There's there's men and there's women, and then of course there's intersex, but that's not a different sex. It's just a problem that's gone wrong with these two sexes.
Right. So, ironically, treating race as some rigid kind of thing is at the heart of racism.
Right.
This race is this thing, classically understood. Of course, the word has been abused so much, it means nothing anymore, absolutely nothing, except for the person who is calling you a racist doesn't like you. That's all it means.
I think if nothing else, this all shows that our culture is very confused about a lot of things right now. And I think it is probably because people are a lot more interested in saying the right things than they are about thinking through things. Mm-hmm. So Joseph, I would say it's a great taking the roof off tactic. Your results may vary, but at the very least, you might get them to think about it, and even maybe not even when they're talking to you, but maybe later on they'll think about it. At the very least, they will understand the claim you're making. Mm-hmm. And by trying to help them understand that you're calling this a physical characteristic that is objective, not something we decide for ourselves, but something that is decided for us, at the very least they'll understand that that's the claim you're making, and maybe they'll look into it later on when mm-hmm. it comes up again for them.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, Greg.
Mm.
So thank you, everyone, for your questions. And please keep sending those on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.